Hello and welcome to On Sacred Ground on the LMC Radio Network on Blog Talk Radio, broadcasting the voices of the land and of the dead by weaving together history, ethnography, and spiritual experience. I'm your host, Kai Armand of ConjureInTheCity.com, and this is our 27th episode of On Sacred Ground, broadcasting at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, on this October 21st, 2015. In this episode, we'll be joined by Aris Rodriguez, a Chicana multimedia producer and digital resistance artivist from San Antonio, Texas. Since 2002, Aris's community-based projects have addressed numerous issues such as environmental racism and justice, family detention, decolonization, cultural arts, guerrilla media, womanism, and public archives. She is the founder and web jefa of Chica Media, a home-based Chicana-powered network of six independent multimedia channels reaching over 120 countries in three languages. She is also a graduate of Mexican-American Studies from the University of Texas at Austin. But before we get to her, we'll be beginning the show, as we do every show, with a passage from the book Earth Prayers from Around the World, 365 prayers, poems, and invocations from around the world. This passage comes to us by Rabbi Rami M. Shapiro. Life and death, a twisted vine sharing a single root. A water bright green, stretching to top a twisted yellow, only to wither itself as another green unfolds overhead. One leaf atop another, yet under the next, a vibrant tapestry of arcs and falls, all in the act of becoming. Death is the passing of life, and life is the stringing together of so many little passings. And without further ado, here is Aris. Aris, are you there?
Yes, hi, Kai. Yes, I'm here. I'm online. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us today. I've been squawking about how excited I am that you're here for like weeks now, because I'm just so excited about this episode and what you have to, the work that you're doing and sharing that work with the people who listen to this show. So I guess we'll just start with, you know, what are you doing right now? I know that you were living in Austin. You recently moved to Jalisco, Mexico, and I know that you're making another move in Mexico. But what's keeping you busy during the day?
Well, during the day, I am blessed to now be just working full time on my activist projects. I am a Chicana multimedia producer, originally from San Antonio, and for the past 13 years, I've actually been pretty heavy in the activist world back in Texas, but doing it on the side, because, you know, that kind of community work doesn't pay, and, you know, there's just a lot of need to resist a lot of oppression that's going on in different forms in my community. And so I was working full time for the man, and then on the side, on any of my free time, just helping my community out and through different projects, but contributing with a little bit of tech skills that I have, just kind of a hodgepodge of different things that the community would need here and there. And now I am in Mexico, where Creator has now made a way for my work to help sustain me financially. And so now I'm doing this full time, and I run a network under the banner of Chica Media. And I run six different channels with a following of over 120 countries and in three different languages. And I just am really focused on these community-based projects and on a form of digital resistance, but now I'm kind of fusing into the spiritual side of that work.
When you mention being in Austin and being in Texas and sort of providing and being a part of and working with your communities, was this specifically like a local community or more of a virtual community or a bit of both?
It turned into both. Initially, 13 years ago, I got involved with an environmental racism case out of South Texas. And I was in San Antonio at the time, and I got pretty heavily involved in organizing on the ground with a community in the valley, in a place that was once declared the most contaminated place in the entire United States by the EPA the year they came out with what they called the Superfund list. And that's where I get started. And so from the network and the community outreach that happened there, just over the years I kept sticking with it and getting involved in different things that were happening across the state. And now my network is international. My base is definitely in the United States. It's expanded beyond Texas. It's definitely across, I guess you could say, the Chicano Mexican American community. But it's now like reaching into other communities that I hadn't foreseen. And I think it has a lot to do just with the times. You know, it's back in the States, there's a lot of racism. There's a lot of hate, fear, and a lot of negative things happening. But at the same time, there's like this huge spiritual awakening. And it seems that I'm kind of in this weird space that's in between resistance and spirituality. And so I'm actually in the middle of a huge growth that it, for me, is now virtual, because I'm not on the ground in the United States, but it's having a real impact in my community, in my country back home. So, you know, I stick with that. That's the path that I feel the universe has me on, and so I'm there and I'm virtually present every day, day in, day out. So that's kind of where I'm at.
So it sounds like there's this inciting moment for you. What were you doing when you encountered this environmental racism case?
At that time, I was actually, I guess you could say, I was lost. I mean, I was in my early 20s. I was a teen mom. And I had graduated early from high school, but I was juggling this world of, you know, being a single parent and also going to college. And so I was very new, very fresh, and not really understanding a lot of the anger that I had felt inside of me since I was a child growing up in the barrio of San Antonio. Back where I'm from, you know, they told us we were Mexicans, and they told us, you know, my city was also very segregated, and so I grew up in underneath this white supremacy that is very pronounced in the South. My middle school, the mascot was a rebel and a Confederate flag, and I mean, I would have that pinned on me for getting honor roll. So you can imagine the type of confusion that it gives to you know, my community and people of color. And long story short, my family, my mother's family is indigenous to Texas. We don't have roots in Mexico. We have roots in Texas, from San Antonio, from Yanaguana, I mean, at least 7 generations back. So you have that added confusion when everyone refers to you as Mexican, and you have no family in Mexico, and you don't know Mexico. So it was like all these layers of confusion that were happening in my life, and just for some reason, Creator put this woman in my path, and she turned out to be a community activist from South Texas, identified as Mexican-American, so I could understand that, you know. But as I got into her story and what she's telling me about the contamination in that town, I felt a connection, and I started to also kind of think about things a little bit. I started seeing that, you know, there was something bigger than just a bunch of people complaining or getting sick. I mean, it ends up that the federal government, the state government, and 30 different huge monster corporations, Dow Chemical, DuPont, Monsanto, are all involved in creating and contaminating this town. And this town is actually the birthplace of Agent Orange. So as I get into this story, I'm a young student, and I start thinking, oh my God, one, this is huge, but two, I start getting like this context of what it means to be a person of color, what it means to be brown in Texas, and to understand that there's like this long-standing history of discrimination, racism, and contamination against the community as a, you know, community of color. And so I started to kind of pitch in with a little bit of technological stuff. You know, at first it was just researching on the internet and giving the community information I would find, because there was the media silence and media blackout over the issue, so they were having trouble trying to figure out what was going on. So I started there, and then just something one day told me, get a camera. So I got a camera, started video recording their stories, and then it turned into something inside my gut telling me, make a website. And at that point, I had never built a website. I had no idea how to build a website, but I had reached a point where I had become comfortable in following my gut and trusting what I felt the universe was telling me. So I learned, and I pieced it together, and boom, that's where I started. That was my first website, and I'm talking in the days before Facebook, and the days before Google, and the days before Twitter, so this is old school. And I pieced it together in something very similar to Microsoft Paint, so you can imagine how horrible it was. But the fact that all of a sudden this voiceless community became present online just freaked these chemical corporations out. And at the time, the community was involved in a major class action lawsuit, so there were over 3,000 plaintiffs fighting 30 chemical companies. And I started getting 50,000 hits a month on that site. Now, as a young student, getting involved for the first time in something of this nature, to get that amount of traffic was just, it was life-changing. And I felt that it was a confirmation from the universe that I was doing something, I was having an impact, and that I needed to continue this path. So here we are 13 years later, and I'm still very involved. I'm still very involved in the technological world and what I'm calling digital resistance. Although now I'm taking it to a different place, because I'm in a different place. Because certainly as an activist, you're dealing with a lot of sadness, a lot of harsh realities, a lot of anger, bitterness, resentment. And at a certain point, I reached a point where I realized that I was living this culture of resistance, and it was toxic to me because I could not filter those emotions. It was bigger than me. So I realized that there needed to be something else I could do that wasn't always in resistance, because resistance implies that something bad has to exist in order for something, you know, to resist it. And so at that point in my life, which is about 7 years ago, halfway into my journey, the doors of the Red Road, or what I call the Red Road, opened up to me, ceremony, to reconnect with my indigenous spiritual beliefs. It just opened up for me. And at that point, my life changed, and I have been able to carry my work through that transition and now move into the more spiritual side of activism. And you could say resistance still, digital resistance, but in a way that is not so consuming and taxing on the spirit. It actually is now, for me, is turning into autonomy. It's turning into art, and it's turning into healing. And so that's where I'm at now. But my roots come from the being on the ground, seeing and basically walking with cancer and death just everywhere around me. And documenting that and digitizing that and seeing that it was being heard and people were sharing the news. And then from there, it just moved on and progressed. And now I'm here.
What an incredible journey. And so, I mean, just to, I guess, provide like a good definition for the listening audience, environmental racism is very much like systemic
racism. It's that it isn't just, you know, some one person comes over and litters in front of you. It's that there are all of these systems in place that enable and encourage an ongoing onslaught of pollution and environmental degradation. Would you sort of agree with that?
That's absolutely correct, and it's actually perpetuated by the different levels of government. In this case, Agent Orange was produced in this town by the 1960s and 1970s, but this town started producing chemicals during a period in time when the farmland in South Texas started falling into corporate hands. And so they mechanized agriculture and started using chemicals to control the different pests, supposedly is what they said, right? But of course, these chemicals had to be produced somewhere, so they specifically targeted the pre-existing Mexican-American neighborhood, got the permissions from the federal government, and had the community come in with no safety gear whatsoever, offered them better wages working in these chemical plants than they were getting out working in the fields or anywhere else, and set up shop in the community, and instead of having smokestacks that would pump out the toxin, they had a fan like half a story taller than the building that was literally shooting the chemicals into the houses. Then we come to find out that the water table is contaminated, and this is since the 50s, and that the corporations and the federal government and universities have been taking what they call biomarkers, like blood tests, and actually studying the effects on the community for at least 5 decades. So environmental racism, it may not always look like what I'm describing, but it's very much institutionalized, and it also falls under the umbrella of what they call remediation, where let's say that you have a situation where the federal government didn't necessarily contaminate a town or an area, but it's a community of color, and now this community is working to get it cleaned up via the federal government and the EPA. Well, sure, they can get in contact with the EPA. Let's say they can even make it on the list of the EPA to be cleaned up. Does it ever happen? And if it happens, how are they handling it? One of the things we saw in this town is that the EPA came in, stepped in, and spent millions and millions of tax dollars to do what they call a cleanup, which was to take the top 6 inches of dirt and replace it with clean dirt, when their studies had shown that the contamination was 16 feet under the ground. And so environmental racism is it manifests in different ways, but is definitely, definitely institutionalized. And in many cases, you'll see it reflected through the actions of the EPA itself at the federal level.
You know, and I've obviously heard of cases similar to this, because these you find stories like this showing up in black communities around the U.S. as well. And it's just so painful, though. It's one of those, it's like every traumatic people's story that is still happening. It's not that you never get tired of listening to it, it's that it never loses its impact. It never stops.
That's correct.
The pain is still, it's a horror. It's a horror story, and the people who are perpetuating it are literally right around you, and they're studying you while you're going through it, because they know what you're putting, you know, they're putting you through. It's a level of heartlessness. The very people that you're supposed to be, you know, calling for support for your social security check, for the fire department, for the police department, you know, it just put me in a state of wow. You know, even though I've heard such similar stories, it never loses its edge. It never loses its impact. The terror of it, because that's what it is. It's terrorism, and it's always about which are the people that are considered the most expendable.
Right.
So you're, this was taking place within a specific community that you were aiding with your, you know, burgeoning digital skills in the early age of the internet. But this was also about a larger community that your work is speaking to on a more global scale even now that, I mean, I would say is the Chicano community, correct?
That's correct, and it actually did bridge out internationally because it turns out that there was a sister site in Indianola, Mississippi, in a black community. And not just that, but when the chemical operations, the chemical plant actually shut down, which is in the 70s, it moved to Bhopal, India. And within a couple of years of setting up shop there, they had that huge disaster that killed something like 50,000 people overnight. So it definitely is an international, had an international impact. But being that this was the first thing that I ever stepped into, I realized since that moment that this was my path. And at the time that I stepped into it, this is before the big immigration became, you know, like a hot topic in the United States. So there, no one wanted to talk about this. No one wanted to hear this, and much less see the devastation. So I was in a very weird place in being the one or being one of the people that had to somehow convey this to the public. So I made mistakes, and I learned a lot along the way, but one of the things I got to see and that was positive for me was to be in the community and have the community open their hearts and connect with me on a human, spiritual level. They had been so downtrodden and so just beaten up through their lives and with their health that, I mean, they had internalized this death. I mean, the going age that they were dying at was, you know, mid-30s, and they thought this was normal. And initially, when I would go around and talk to people, they would say, oh, pues, así lo quería Dios, which is, oh, I guess, you know, God wants it that way. Or they would say, pues hice algo malo en mi otra vida, which is like, oh, I must have done something wrong in a past life. And they had internalized this. And so when I stepped in, they had not wanted to talk about it openly with each other or their neighbors. I mean, the silence was profound and it was very deep. But I don't know why I came in with the camera and I sat with them, I cried with them, and they just poured their hearts out. So at the same time that I'm witnessing the suffering, I'm witnessing the essence of the human spirit, the resilience of the human spirit. And that is also the beginning for me of my spiritual path, although at the time I didn't know it. What we're talking about is so heavy and so intense. And, you know, imagine I was in my early 20s feeling lost in the world, and all of a sudden, you know, I'm jumping into this head first. Well, it gave me a very strong foundation, which has carried me for the past 13 years to get to this point. And as a matter of fact, it's actually the next book that I'm working on. I'm going to publish everything I have on that case, because I, you can imagine, I've got all sorts of files and pictures and top secret documents, and I'm just coming out with it all, and I'm going to give it away for free. But I'm going to compile it into a book that can be used in the universities, that, you know, can be kept and made history so that no one can take it away, so that these stories are never forgotten, so that the voices of the people are, you know, can be heard forever.
And you took the word right out of my mouth. You literally said it as I was thinking it, you know, the word witness, that, you know, trauma needs a witness. And when it, because so often trauma, whether it is on an individual experience as an individual or as a community, is so profound that it induces silence. It induces an unconsciousness and a silence, especially if that trauma has no way out. And simply being a witness and, you know, opens up a portal for that trauma to speak and express itself, and then healing can begin. So yeah, you were, I mean, from my viewpoint, you were absolutely led to step into that role. And it almost sounds like you were also stepping into that role from this outsider-insider perspective, because you weren't a part of that community, but yet you had similar identity. You had similar identity to people in that community that enabled you to step in and possibly perform a, create a bond that other people outside of that identity might not have had, yet be able to hold space for witnessing as someone who wasn't directly affected by this specific environmental racism.
That's correct. And it also gave me context because, like I was telling you, I had grown up with this confusion about what it meant to be Mexican, or that people would tell me I was Mexican, or that my mother even identified as Mexican. And we were from Texas. Well, after getting into this and you know, just being in the trenches like this, I eventually intellectualized what was happening, and I ended up also studying Chicano studies, or what they call Mexican American studies, at the University of Texas at Austin. I have a degree in that. And what I did there is basically intellectualize the work, the community work I was doing to get the degree, because I felt that it needed to be addressed on that level in the university. But it gave me this context, and it helped me to understand that this concept of environmental racism, when applied to us as Chicanos, Mexican Americans, or indigenous cultures, because we are indigenous to the Americas, that it was an ongoing form of colonization. And it connected me to the same things that were happening, that are happening with the corporations today in Brazil or in the rainforest, to the native communities there. So through this, I have reached the point where I'm seeing that this is ongoing colonialism. And so it has been a journey, and has not been easy to come to these understandings, but I'm here. And so I feel blessed by Creative to have witnessed that and experienced that, and now kind of just grown and keep growing and blossoming into the next phase of my life.
You mentioned the Bhopal disaster, and I just want to take a quick mention of that. For those of you who don't know, the Bhopal disaster was another act of environmental racism, not on U.S. soil, but actually taking place in India many years back. And just as Irish has shared with us, a tremendous amount of people died, and the aftermath is still ongoing. The chemical leaks that took place are still happening, and there has been no retribution to the people who have been living there. And the medical costs, of course, are absurd to keep people living through what they've gone through. And we're going to be speaking more about digital resistance before this episode is over, but I wanted to just mention how sort of a different form of resistance showed up in that disaster in 2007. The performance activist group known as the Yes Men did a very cool thing where they set... Actually, it is a form of digital resistance. They actually set up a website that looked like Dow Chemical's website right around the time of the anniversary of the Bhopal disaster. And because their website looked just like Dow's website, they were contacted to give an interview on national television, in which they said, "We're sorry for what happened," and Dow's stocks fell. Because no one had ever apologized. So definitely, you know, if you're listening, definitely check out the Bhopal disaster, the anniversary of which, the tragic anniversary of which, is coming up this December 2nd. But also check out the Yes Men's response to the Bhopal disaster that took place on BBC back in 2007. You'll find that on YouTube. Resistance is creative. And but it's exhausting, as you said. And I, right after this break, I want to talk about what sort of saved you, because I myself, you know, as an activist, as well as someone who's been involved in activist communities, I know a lot about what that burnout can look like, and that there is definitely a potential for constant anger. To witnessing is not a passive act. It's an active space that can be very difficult. But you definitely were able to delve even deeper than you realized you were going, and were able to receive some tools to be able to witness in an even bigger and better way. And we're going to be talking about that right after this break.
Yana wana ho yana, ho yana, yana wana ho yana. going, hey, Nayo.
And we're back with Iris Rodriguez of ChicaMedia.com and ChicanaChronicles.com. We are talking about environmental racism. We're talking about racism. We are talking about resistance in the Chicano community and resistance against colonizing forces. Iris, we were right before we took that break, we were talking a bit about what it takes to heal and come to grips with what one is witnessing. When you really pull back the veil and you see, this is our world. This isn't a world past. This is a heartlessness that is continuing in our world. And you mentioned earlier in the episode that you were blessed to find the Red Road. I know that from my own reading of your blog. I'm so thoroughly moved by one of the passages when you talk about that experience of acceptance. You were in a traditional ceremony and you were sort of feeling lost, and you mentioned that there were some women around you that said, no, these are yours, that these are your traditional medicine ways. You have these are your part of your birthright, and that this was an experience of stepping in for you. Could you go into this a bit deeper?
Yes. They say that the folks that sometimes end up at ceremonies are the sick ones, and I certainly felt that way. I at the time I stepped into ceremony, it had been 7 years of activism, 7 years of stepping, you know, with my first project being this environmental racism case. It was heavy from the get-go. And I felt that I was walking beside death for a long time, and I was being asked by many people on their deathbed, please tell my story, please share my story with the world. And this was heavy on me, and I promised I would do it, but at the time I had no idea how to do it. I just knew that I was placed in that moment at that time and hitting record on that button for a reason. And so that had been very heavy and made my spirit very heavy, on top of just a lot of the things that I had personally been dealing with, being a young brown woman from Texas, a teen mom coming up in good old boy Southern racism and segregation. And I was very angry, and the more I found out about the injustices in my community, not just where I was from, but across my state, across the country, on both sides of the border, it was just a heavy toll, and I felt so angry, and it was a lot. So I was praying, and I was praying to the universe and just asking, you know, the stars, help me out here, because this is too much. I can't take this. This is too much for me. I can't do this anymore. Make a way. Please make a way for me. And I was through one of the activist circles that I was in. The opportunity to go to ceremony opened up. And by ceremony, I mean teepee. It was a medicine ceremony. And I went. And when I stepped in for the first time, I was home. I step in across that threshold. I see the fire in the center of that teepee, and I immediately get this sense of returning home after a long time. And I had not had this feeling of home ever, or at least in a very, very long time. Like, felt like it had been lifetime since I had been there. But since that moment, I connected, and I had never connected in such a real way with anything. And so we have the TP ceremony, which is all night long, stay up singing songs, eating medicine. And when we wake up in the morning, when morning time comes and it's time to step out of the teepee, we step out, and one of the relatives, we call each other relatives in there, one of the native relatives came up to me, you know, we all say good morning, and he looked at me and he said, oh, what nation are you from? And I hadn't, up until that point, I had been told I was Mexican all my life. I knew that I wasn't, because I didn't have family in Mexico, or that I wasn't politically Mexican. But I looked around and I was just like, I don't know, I'm just Chicana. And then my friend, who had been to ceremony before, looks over at me with a huge smile on her face, and she says, "Girl, didn't you know? You're part of the Chicano Nation. We have a birthright to this medicine." And those words will forever stick in my mind. And it was from that point forward that I started researching, started talking to elders, started connecting the dots, and realizing that as a person of indigenous ancestry here to the Americas, and in particular from Texas, that we are from a holy land where the sacred peyote medicine grows. And it only grows in two places in the world, in South Texas and across the mountains into Jalisco, which is where I'm actually at, or going to very, very soon, returning to very soon. And it's not a coincidence. And this medicine is very sacred for us. It's been incorporated into the ceremonial ways in what we call the North, through the North American tribes and what they now call the Native American Church, which was established in the 1800s as a way to continue in praying the way that indigenous people prayed, but with the federal government kind of giving the okay to keep doing that at a time when they were coming down on Native peoples for being Native, for having long hair, you know, for being who we were. This Native American church now incorporated the use of the peyote medicine, which originally came from Texas, and now, I mean, it's still used in ceremony and regarded as basically like a telephone to God. And so it's just funny because I had no idea that I was part of this rich, rich heritage that was connected to a holy land, because it had never been spoken of that way or put into that context growing up. I mean, being from Texas, you're told, okay, yeah, there were Indians, the Spanish came, and they helped them out and put them in missions, and then the white people came, and then more white people came, and then more white people came, and that's the story. But you're never told, oh, by the way, you come from the sacred, one of the most sacred spots in the Americas that people from Canada, Alaska would travel to, from Chile, Argentina would travel to in intergenerational journeys to come harvest this medicine in a ceremonial way. We're not told that. So getting back to the teepee, when my friend gives me this knowledge, I mean, that seed sat planted in me firmly. And over years, as I began to unpeel the layers of history and historical lies and colonization that had been put over my eyes, I start to realize that Texas is a holy land. And I start to realize the importance of decolonization and what it means to be Chicana, be Mexican American, and to take these layers off. And so that changed the way that I started, that I was doing my community work and my digital resistance, and it took me on a different path. That moment is where it starts. And so the past 13 years of my life are broken into two parts, the part before ceremony and the part after ceremony. That's a little bit about that story.
Yeah, because there's absolutely, when someone visits your website, there's a depth to what you're saying about what it means to be Chicana that is more than have pride in yourself because you're awesome. You're saying, no, you're sacred, and you come from a long line. You're saying you have context, and I had an experience myself recently where I had my own ancestry DNA test, and when the results came, I didn't know what to do. I literally just sat looking at them. You're just looking at these percentages and these places in the world, and a tear came to my eye, and it was just literally this moment of, I'm from somewhere, I have context, and I've been on this, you know, earth for, you know, 30 years, and I, the first time I felt like I had not just context to, you know, a diasporic community and the things that people were able to do in the midst of colonization and in resistance to colonization, because that often is what defines people of color. We're often defined by resistance. And, oh, you guys were able to put this dish together even though we took everything away from you. Or you were able to make this dance so happy, you know. And it's, and you're to be defined by resistance versus sort of a sense of a natural way of being in the world is a whole different experience, this idea of context. So I resonate with you very much there. And I am getting the ping that we have to talk about not just sort of Chicanidad, pero also Chicana. Can we talk about Chicana? Can we talk about las mujeres in the, and not just acutely, but the medicine of las mujeres, I guess, you know, throughout history, and what this means to you?
Well, I have to admit, I am not much of a reader in the academic sense anymore, because I, you know, I'm not studying or anything anymore. And on top of that, like, I feel like I get so caught up in the work I'm doing to stop and read a book anymore. But I can try to answer that with what I have experienced and what I know to be true. As part of a group of women in Texas that stepped into the ceremonial ways at the same time, I had a group of sisters that were with me. We identified as activists. We identified as Chicanas, Mexican Americans. And this was before ceremony, but once we stepped into ceremony, they also had this awakening with me. And in the years since then, we've all witnessed that we weren't the only women, the only brown women or women of color to have these spiritual awakenings. We, as Chicanas, stepping into ceremony, I mean, it was difficult because at the time, you know, ceremony, you think teepee, you think Indian, you think Native American. Right off the bat, you're not thinking Mexican. Right off the bat, you're not thinking Mexican American. And so it was very, at first it was difficult because there were some spaces where not having that tribal card almost delegitimize our presence there, because it's not easy to get into ceremony. I mean, they say that the door only opens to certain people and it's only at a certain time. It's controlled by the universe. It's not controlled by invitations, you know, on paper or by Facebook. But the fact that it happened to several of us women at the same time made us feel that we were a part of this spiritual awakening. And in the years since then, I have witnessed other sisters, all, you know, could be Chicana, could be Black, could be from different communities, reconnect with their own indigenous roots to reach into themselves and get and facilitate, help push out this inner queen, this very ancient knowledge that's just embedded in our solar plexus, where we're reconnecting with our old medicines. Why? My take on that is because the earth is calling us to help her. And it's coming, I see it coming from the women. And that's actually part of the reason I created Chicana Chronicles a little over a year ago. Chicana Chronicles is a website that just started out as like a blog, but I wanted to invite different sisters or different women that I knew that they were activists, but they also had this creative, artistic side that was, I felt like I needed to help give folks a platform where they could get this journey, they could document this journey, and we could somehow collectively decolonize and collectively go through this spiritual awakening. And it has since just gone viral. And in this virality, what I have come to find out is that it's happening all across the world. and it's happening across with women from many different nations and men from many different nations and people who identify beyond the constructs of men and women. It's a spiritual awakening that's happening on this earth, and we're being called, I feel, we're being called by the earth, and the way to connect with her is through that indigenous knowledge which sits inside us. And so some of us are more attuned to it than others, and we're waking up and we're reconnecting. But there's something to be said about the feminine energy and the way that it's perpetuating across the physical and the virtual world. I the best way I can explain it is that maybe, you know, as a feminine entity myself, you know, I feel that I'm a representation of creator of the universe, and my job is to bring beauty and reconnection to the earth. And that's how I'm manifesting it. And I've been given this digital vision and to create and open the doors and the space for other sisters like myself to also put out their work and their words and their art. And I've just received confirmation after confirmation after confirmation that this is the right thing for me to do. And so what I feel is that the attack on Mother Earth is also an attack on the feminine. And for that reason, it's the feminine energy that is waking up, and through us, we're reaching into our old medicines and bringing it back out to help Mother Earth, which is taking care of all of us. So I know that's really deep,
Yes, bring it. this is the place.
That's
for
where
it.
I'm. But that's what I see, and I guess that's the best way I could answer that question.
Well, I had an emotional quake as you were speaking. And a tear ran down my eye, and I found myself lighting up a cigarillo, and things happened that were supposed to happen right now. So thank you for being vulnerable and going there into your subjective and sharing your subjective personal experience from that deep place. Truly, I think that people who are listening to the show needed to hear exactly what you just said. And beauty you are creating, not just via your website, but also via the unity and weaving that you mentioned, which is shown in the piece that we just played a little while ago, the Chicana, the songs to the four directions that you recorded with your children.
Yes, thank you. That was a little bit embarrassing because as I understand ceremony and as I understand the things that happen in TP and in the Red Road and when you pray, you're not supposed to share it. And so I stepped into ceremony and I immediately just resonated with the songs that were being sung, and I began singing them, and I've been singing them for 7 years now at home, in my own prayers, with my own family, and not sharing them. But a couple of weeks ago, I just felt this urge, and it was nagging at me, you need to sing these songs, put your prayers down, sing your four songs to the four directions, and publish it. And I felt that it was going to be really controversial. I didn't want to go there, but I did. And after doing that, and since doing that, my work has just gone exponentially viral. The songs got shared, the post got shared almost 1,500 times, which is crazy for me, living in Mexico, not having been in my own country in 3 years. And to produce I have such a niche in my work. It's addressing a very niche ideology and community, and to be shared like that, and just the positive feedback that I got back, I realized that I'm being called to share this medicine. And so the songs that you just heard are songs that the first couple of songs that I learned as a Chicana. Because there are songs from different nations that are sung in ceremony, but those are the first songs that I learned, and now that I've shared with the public. I do know songs from other nations, but I'm not at the point yet of sharing those because they're personal prayers. But due to the overwhelming response from sharing this music, I am in the process of recording a CD and putting it out through one of my networks, which is actually a musical production network. It's called Descatlipoca Records. And I'm going to cross over into music. I'm actually married to a musical family. My husband is part of an intergenerational musical family out of Guadalajara, Mexico, and they play using the ancient instruments of Mexico. And he grew up in that tradition, and now he and his siblings have a product that is a fusion of the ancestral music and the ancestral instrumentation with electronica. And so for the past couple of years since we've been married, I've actually been running his website and running his network. But from behind the scenes, I hadn't even thought of myself as a musician in any way. But now with this song being out, I'm crossing over, and I'm going to be vulnerable and expose these prayers, not all of them, but the ones that I think are really pertinent for the Mexican-American Chicano community to learn, which those songs are rooted in words from our territories. They're in English, they're in Spanish, they're in Nahuatl, and those are it's just a way for our people to connect, to reconnect with their indigenous heritage and to basically reach deep into their DNA and reactivate it. So that in this process of decolonization that they begin to feel, and this journey back to the ancestral, that they also journey back to this reconnection with Earth. And that is my ultimate goal. With all the work that I do, and in particular with the spiritual music that I'm crossing over into now, my purpose is to help wake people up so that they can reconnect with their ancient ancestral DNAs that were connected to the earth, because the earth needs our help. So I know, again, I'm going to go deep, but that's the ultimate goal of everything that I do. And it just so happens I'm packaged with this Chicana label. But hopefully this message can reach people from all nations, and they can do this type of thing themselves and reconnect in their own way, in a healthy way, to the earth, because she's in trouble.
Well, you know, I really do believe that it's microcosm, macrocosm, and what takes place in the local reverberates through the larger. You know, obviously, to me, your work has tremendous meaning, despite not being of Mexican nor Chicano heritage. But it's so obvious, seeing your work, that this is more than, you know, this is of the lens that your work is being delivered through, but it is meant to speak to all nations. And before we take this next break, I want to just give a quick shout out to the Indiegogo campaign that you currently have going for Chicana Chronicles and the publishing house that this is, that it's not just a website and blog and media resource, but that you're also publishing multiple ebooks on decolonization and environmental racism and Chicana art. And I just want to give a quick shout out to that. We're going to be mentioning it again before the show is over. Absolutely, if you're listening to the show, go over to Indiegogo.com and type in Chicana Chronicles, Chicana with an X-I-C-A-N-A, and provide some support to these wonderful projects that are going on, that are on behalf of, as we've been talking about, on behalf of Earth, on behalf of, you know, on behalf of life. Really, that's what this work is about. This is about what serves life, and it absolutely serves life for us to be decolonizing our communities and our world and our minds, because really colonization is the idea of separation, and that we would be separate from one another to be able to enact the kinds of atrocities that we were talking about at the beginning of the show. So we're going to be taking a quick break, and next up we actually have some music from Iris's husband, who is a part of the group Yetla Nesi, and we'll be talking a bit about the piece that just played right after this break.
Is a media alliance whose excellent shows include The Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour, hosted by Catherine Ironwood and Kanjaman Ali, Sundays 3 to 4:30. Candelo's Corner, starring Candelo Cambisa, Mondays 5 to 7. The Crystal Silence League Hour, hosted by John St. Germain, Tuesdays 5 to 6. In the Streets with Beverly Smith, Tuesdays 6 to 7. On Sacred Ground with Kai Armand, Wednesdays 5 to 7. The Now You Know Show with Professor Charles Porterfield, Thursdays 6 to 7:30. And Liquid Libations with Andrea Weston, Saturdays 5 to 7. All times Pacific, at 3 hours for Eastern, sponsored by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company in Forestville, California, and online at luckymojo.com.
Lucky Mojo Curio Company is based in sunny Forestville, California, and provides traditional spiritual products for remediating all kinds of conditions. Locate them online at luckymojo.com or visit them in person to see the world's smallest church, Missionary Independent Spiritual. And we are back. I'm your host, Kai Armand, and we are with Iris Rodriguez of ChicaMedia.com and ChicanaChronicles.com. We have been talking about the beauty of the Red Road and finding who you are through indigenous ceremony, as well as environmental racism and racism in the U.S. And we did provide a little bit of context to this before, but you mentioned that you were living in Austin, Texas, where you were doing your studies, and you only recently moved to Mexico. Can you talk a bit about the decision to make that move?
Absolutely. Having grown up in segregation, being from San Antonio, and later, you know, going through all these experiences as an activist, getting into the Red Road, and then working at the state government in a high-ranking position within the headquarters of the state health department, it was hard on my spirit because as a person of color, I was surrounded by a lot of white men, a lot of what I would call WASHU ideals, white supremacist ideals. And it was just very hard, just simply being a woman. If you, any of you are following Texas politics, it's very misogynist. And in particular, there's this like particular hate against brown women. So you can imagine, here I am, conscious, doing all that work on the side, at home, for free, volunteering it, and then, but getting paid to do, to work for the state and help perpetuate these horrific laws that were against my community, that were against my ideals, and then being hated on top of that for even being there in the first place. I did it for a couple of years, and I just reached a point where, you know, I was coming home sick, emotionally sick, spiritually sick, because it's not very easy to have to deal with racism on a daily basis. I mean, there's microaggressions and there's microaggressions. And if you have no way to get that out, that's really toxic. But on top of that, I reached the point where I was having to balance, okay, is this money really worth what's happening to my spirit? Am I doing what the universe has called me to do, am I doing that work? Or am I here biding my time because I have to pay this bill and that bill and this student loan and that student loan? And it was really toxic, and I couldn't take it anymore. And there was just a lot of other things going on within the state, and I just couldn't deal with it. And it, being that my husband was Mexican, that added another layer of toxin that was affecting our home life. Because at the time in Austin, there was the 287G law, which basically gave local police the authority to detain people that they suspected were undocumented. What that means in real terms is that they were given basically a license to pick out people that looked Mexican enough, harass them, detain them, deport them. But of course, you know, by way of a private prison here or there where they could squeeze some slave labor out of them before they send them back. And so the environment in Austin at the time was really oppressive, and we just felt that it was not the right place for our family. And then also, you know, adding to that the layer of craziness that a lot of these Texans have with, you know, the gun laws. Now, I'm not particularly fond of that, but they were trying to pass legislation to allow teachers to go armed to school, and I just didn't feel that it was a good environment for my kids. So we made the decision to leave, and I gave it up to God, gave it up to Creator and the universe, and said, look, I'm being called to do this type of work. I feel that it's coming from you. If you would like me to continue doing it, please make a way for me. And it happened. I left. I haven't been back in 3 years, and I had to learn a lot. I ended up getting having to do virtual work and join the virtual workforce. And in that process, it was actually very humbling because I started to realize that the skills I had been donating to my community for free were actually worth something. And not just anything, but that I actually had a couple of pretty good abilities. I had developed some pretty good skills that made me competitive in the global virtual marketplace. So that helped me because it gave me an understanding that I had value. And as a brown woman, I mean, that was profound. Because I had been giving away my abilities in the past and to good causes and for good reasons, but I finally began to value myself in that respect. And so slowly but surely, I kind of got off of that, and now the universe has made a way for me to actually do the work that I'm calling, that I'm being called to do. In specific, the projects that I'm working on, I run several networks, but the two that come to my mind right now are the Chicana Chronicles Publishing House, and the second would be the music. I've already kind of told you about the music and the upcoming CD I have, or I will have in the next couple of weeks. But the Chicana Chronicles Publishing House is where I feel I'm being called to do. And I'm basically, again, with the number four, I'm putting out, I put out a public call for support through the Indiegogo to help fund a community-based publishing house where the community donations would go towards the actual publication and compilation of these books. And then the authors of the books would get 100% of the funds that come in for these books. So it's very community based in that way. And so the first book that I'm working on, that I should have out in the next couple of weeks, next 2 or 3 weeks max, is actually called Digital Resistance 101, and it's where I document the intersections of my experience, you know, as an activist. Through activism, technology, resistance, and spirituality. And the next book is going to be about the Mission Texas environmental racism case. And that book I'm going to just give away because that's beyond me, and I have no reason to make money off of that. So I'm going to package it for the public and give that away. And then I have a couple of other books coming out. One is about returning to the Red Road, and which is the process of decolonization through the Chicana lens, and returning back into this relationship with Earth and relationship to being an indigenous person, and all the questions that come along with that regarding tribal identities and all of that. And then also a book of Chicana Tejana art that's going to be a compilation of artworks from different mujeres from Texas, different women from Texas, who are also in this process of decolonization and this spiritual awakening, receiving their own visions, and I'm going to help package that and put it out. And my point with that project is to create a virtual codex that can never be burned. Why? Because I feel that we are part of a generation with a power that is unprecedented. Our ancestors did not have the opportunity to connect with the world at the push of a button, or to share their stories, good or bad, at the push of a button. We've had our books burned. We've had our books banned. We've had our histories taken from us, buried by force and violently. So I feel incredibly blessed and incredibly committed to helping create this virtual codex that can never be burned. Even if they ban it, even if it gets blocked, the second I hit publish or the second it gets disseminated, people are going to be able to view it, share it, print it, and that's where it's at for me. So that and the music are the two like big projects I have coming up.
And this is why you listeners need to go over to Indiegogo.com to Chicana Chronicles, Xicana Chronicles, and support this work, because it is amazing work and it's revolutionary work. If we could talk for a second about expanding a bit more on the idea of digital resistance.
Digital resistance. It's been a journey. It has taken me 13 years to come to these realizations. And I have to be honest, I've been so busy fighting that I haven't really had the time to pick up books and read what other people's perspectives and ideas are on this. But I've come to certain conclusions. One of which is that the virtual world is more like the spiritual world than the physical. As a person that is involved, that is an activist, not only that has been an activist on the ground, but that is an activist online, very deeply entrenched into different community causes, you come to find out that the information that you're taking in, yes, through your eyes, you're reading things, or you're hearing things, or you're watching videos, yes, it's stimulating your senses, but it's touching your spirit. And there is a spiritual pull that happens in having to filter this, a lot of this, you're filtering a lot of this anger, this hate, and a lot of things that you're witnessing. And again, if you don't have a place to let it out, if you don't have a way to get it out, it can be very toxic. And so I've realized that being a digital warrior is a fusion of several things. It's not only intellectual. It's not only technological or digital. It's very much a spiritual path. It's not just the war path. It's a spiritual path. And it requires self-care. It requires having to do limpias. In my case, that's what I do. I have to actually do ceremonies to either bless my work or help me filter out or filter in whatever, you know, the good and the bad that I'm coming across as I'm involved in these different virtual war fronts. So I felt the need to put this into book form because I'm exhausted, and I know if I'm one of the very few people that is in this fusion of worlds that is a mix of activism and a mix of digital, in the digital realm, and I just felt the need that I needed to document my experience and give it to communities of color who are also experiencing injustice. That way they don't have to go through the pain that I went through to realize that it is also a very, you know, a very personal and spiritual journey just to be involved in this. There's a lot of things that get perpetuated, both good things and bad things, you know, online. And so it's a very, you know, very real world. Even though it's a virtual digital world, it very much can very much affect your physical reality. And so I've nailed it down to 10 key core concepts that every community in resistance should know as they strategize and arm themselves to resist whatever is oppressing them.
I love it, and I can't wait for these books to come out. I really, really can't. But before we close out the episode, I would love to give more mention to the music we just heard from your husband's group, Yetlanesi. Can you tell us more about sort of their mission and the fusion that's happening in their sounds?
Yes. They are actually in an intergenerational group. The music that they play is, Yetlanesi is composed of the three siblings from this family, the Borsigi family, but they grew up in a group, their family group was called Wewit, which is the ancient drum that we use in ceremony. Now, this family, through the generations, has maintained and preserved the ancestral knowledge of how to construct indigenous musical ceremonial instrumentation using the earth and the elements. So they've preserved it all the way to this generation. And up until they turned into Yetlanesi, up until they were Wewit, they strictly played music using that instrumentation. They did not fuse any sort of electronic anything into their music. And the first time I heard Wewit, I mean, I was blown away because I was watching, you know, the mother playing with the kids and these sounds that just seemed to be moving the wind around them and the elements around them. I mean, it was just this ancestral sound that was shaking up my DNA and the people around me. And so I just fell in love with that. I had never experienced something so profound aside from ceremony. So I got involved in the project, and as Yetla and Nefi began to take form, which is the three siblings, they reached a point where they realized that they needed to take this sound, this ancestral knowledge and ancestral sound, to the next generation. But doing that would require having to give it a more electronic sound and a more a sound that resonated more with the digital generation that we're a part of. So they have fused it with electronic instrumentation, and now their group is called Yetla Nefi, which means cosmic dawn in Nahuatl. And their project is doing what it was doing, but is doing it now for the younger people and the people that want to be able to hear a more modern version of the ancient music. And now that I'm involved, we're going to take it to the next level, because through Yetla Nefi and Chica Media, we have created a publishing house called Tezcatlipoca Records, and that's the publishing house, the musical publishing house, through which we publish the Yetla Nefi CD, and through which I'm going to publish my music. But through that house, we realized that this music needed to be tied in to the growing spiritual awakening that's happening in this earth-based consciousness. So we're actually in the we're in the process of creating the next Yetla Nefi CD, and they're going to take their work and tie it back into Mother Earth. So it's becoming the sounds of the future that reconnect you with your environment. So it's a way of, I guess you could call it resistance, but it's more covert, and it's definitely musical, and it's a very exciting project, because when someone goes to listen, I mean, they're moved by what they're hearing, and now that we're going to add this visual layer of video that's going to take them back to the earth and the earth elements and the organic elements, we're hoping to move people's hearts to reconnect with the earth, because once again, she needs our help, and once again, that is what I'm here to do, to help people wake up and reconnect with the earth. And so now, through that project, we're able to do that musically, and hopefully it'll have a wide audience, and people will tune into that frequency and jump on board.
Well, yeah, we're going to do our best to promote this beautiful music. And if people want to actually go buy the current album that's out by Yetla Nefi, where would someone find it?
They could go to yetlanefi.com, which is YETLANEZI.com, yetlanefi.com. You can also go through Chica Media, my website, and look up Yetla Nefi. Chica Media is spelled XICAMEDIA.com. And you can find the Yetla Nefi link there. You can find us through that website and buy it online. And there's also on yetlanefi.com, there's some videos, so if you'd like to check them out. They're older recordings, but you can get a sense of where the music, what it's all about.
This is awesome. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us and your husband's work and the work of these communities that are so resilient in the face of everything that's been going on, and for providing such a beautiful light in the midst of this experience. It has been a privilege to have.
For those of you who are just tuning in, this has been special guest Iris Rodriguez of ChicaMedia.com and ChicanaChronicles.com, both starting with an X. Thank you so much for being a wonderful guest, and thank you so much, listeners, for tuning in. This has been another episode of On Sacred Ground, broadcasting the voices of the land and of the dead by weaving together history, ethnography, and spiritual experience. Tune in next week for another episode as we continue to go deep into the heart of the human experience, in which place plays a primary role. Until then, keep a light in your window for courage in our times. I'll be keeping a light in mine. God bless.
stairway. So I
keep a light in my window.
I want to be there to help us.